Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Student Loans and Bankruptcy Post-Argument Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 1st, 2009, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in United Student Aid Funds, Incorporated v. Espinoza. The question in this case is whether a bankruptcy court order discharging a student loan debt without a finding of undue hardship issued after an adversary hearing is void. To discuss the case, we have the William Benjamin Scott and Luna M. Scott Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, Professor G. Marcus Cole. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Cole.
United Student Aid Funds versus Espinoza is interesting because it pits two fundamental concepts of bankruptcy law against each other. And it's difficult to imagine how the court might craft a decision that allows both important principles to escape unscathed. The question before the court in Espinoza is whether a bankruptcy court's discharging of the debtor's student loan debt is valid when the debtor hasn't demonstrated undue hardship through the required heightened notice and adversary hearing procedures mandated by the Federal Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure. During 1988 and 1989, the respondent, Francisco Espinoza, obtained four federally guaranteed student loans totaling over $13,000. In 1992, Espinoza filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy, identifying the student loans as his only debt. In his bankruptcy plan, he mailed to the petitioner, United Student Aid Funds, and I'll call them USAF, the holder of his loans, notice that he was proposing to repay only the principal owed on the loans and not the interest and penalties. USAF filed a proof of claim in the bankruptcy court for $17,832 for both principal and interest. The bankruptcy court, however, entered a confirmation order approving Espinoza's plan as submitted, that is, requiring him to repay only $13,250. Espinoza never initiated an adversary proceeding as required by the bankruptcy rules, nor did the court make an undue hardship finding as required by the bankruptcy code. Instead, the bankruptcy trustee simply mailed USAF a form notice indicating that the repayment amount approved by the court was different from the amount that USAF had claimed. After Espinoza completed the payments required by the Chapter 13 plan, the bankruptcy court entered a discharge order that enjoined Espinoza's creditors from attempting to collect on his debts, again without any finding of an undue hardship with regard to the student loans. 3 years later, USAF attempted to collect the additional money owed by Espinoza by garnishing his federal income tax refunds. Espinoza then reopened his bankruptcy case to secure an order that would prohibit his creditors from collecting on his discharged debts. USAF then, in turn, sought to avoid the original confirmation order, arguing that it had been entered in violation of the code and rules, and accordingly was void. The bankruptcy court ruled in Espinoza's favor, but the district court reversed, holding that the confirmation order was void, and remanded the case for an adversary hearing to determine whether Espinoza faced undue hardship. The Ninth Circuit reversed and remanded. In its view, USAF's argument that the violation of the bankruptcy code and rules rendered the confirmation and discharge orders void was foreclosed by its 1999 decision holding that a discharge is a final judgment which can only be challenged on direct appeal. After its petition for rehearing en banc was denied, USAF petitioned for cert, which was granted last June. In its brief, USAF relies on the text of the code and the court's precedent that student debt is non-dischargeable absent an undue hardship determination, which must in turn be obtained through an adversary proceeding. Because the court's confirmation of the plan, including student debt, exceeded the authority granted to it by law, its judgment, according to USAF, was void and could be attacked under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. USAF argues that neither the confirmation nor the discharge order is res judicata because of the code's finality provision, Section 1327A. doesn't apply to provisions that are contrary to law. USAF also argues that the undesirable effects of the Ninth Circuit's rule would not be limited to student loan context. The rule would, in conflict with Congress's express judgment that some debts are non-dischargeable, it would allow other debts, such as debts from unpaid taxes and from certain tort judgments and fines, including criminal sentences, to be discharged by declaration, as USAF argues happened in this particular case. Espinosa, as well as the various amici that joined him in this case, along with the Chapter 13 trustees, counter this argument by emphasizing the important reliance interest of trustees and creditors in the finality of confirmed plans, and arguing that the code's finality provision precludes USAF's attack on the confirmation order. Espinosa relies on Travelers Indemnity Company versus Bailey, in which the court recently held that plaintiffs could not bring suit 20 years after the bankruptcy court issued an injunction, even if the bankruptcy court exceeded its jurisdictional power in so doing. Espinosa also dismisses the textual argument made by the U.S. in its amicus brief that student debt simply cannot be discharged without an undue hardship determination as not properly before the court. Finally, Espinosa argues that USAF's due process argument fails because heightened procedural requirements can be waived, and the actual notice which USAF admittedly received meets the constitutional minimum. Now, the only thing that is unquestionably clear in this case is that the bankruptcy court erred in entering a discharge order that included the respondent's student loans without an adversary hearing and a showing by the debtor that the failure to discharge the loan would pose an undue hardship on him. This is ordinarily a very difficult standard to meet and is rarely granted, and this is for good reason. Normally, when a person borrows money, the lender is lending against the borrower's present ability to repay the loan. The lender prices the interest rate based upon the borrower's current income, assets, and creditworthiness. Student loans, however, are different. Typically, students are people who have limited present ability to repay a loan. They typically have limited assets and frequently have little or no income. The purpose of the loan is to enable the student to build up his human capital so that his future income will be significant and sufficient to repay the loan. In other words, unlike the normal lending situation, where a borrower is borrowing against present assets and present ability to repay, student loans enable the borrower to borrow against his future. Because the lender is lending against the student's future ability to repay, such a loan is substantially riskier than other types of loans. Indeed, the risk associated with such lending might raise the cost of borrowing so high that most students could not afford to borrow, and many lenders would simply refrain from extending such credit. Congress recognized this problem and addressed it in two ways. First, it provided a guarantee for student loans, assuring lenders repayment in the event of default. Second, it rendered student loans non-dischargeable in bankruptcy absent a demonstration of undue hardship. The rationale is that while ordinary creditors' claims may be forced to be resolved using the pool of assets against which they lent, a bankruptcy cannot accomplish this for a lender of a student loan. The student loan creditor has lent against an asset that does not yet exist, namely the future income generated by the human capital made possible by the student loan. The problem presented by the present case is that the bankruptcy court clearly erred in discharging the student loan without a hearing, but the bankruptcy order entering the discharge was not challenged until 6 years after it was entered. This implicates perhaps more important principle of bankruptcy, namely that bankruptcy orders enjoy finality. Bankruptcy is, at its core, a regime of equity, not law. In the typical bankruptcy scenario, where the debtor is solvent, the fact of the matter is that the legal rights of the creditors must necessarily be abridged. All creditors cannot have their legal rights vindicated in full. Accordingly, we address these legal claims with an equitable solution. we pay the claimants on a pro rata basis. But to impose the solution on all creditors, we must have all creditors participating in a timely fashion. We must also have the resolution of their claims be final so that all involved can move on. This does not mean that creditors cannot appeal final orders, but it does mean that bankruptcy cases should not be reopened years after they're concluded. In the present case, while the bankruptcy court made a grievous error in granting the respondents discharge, it is difficult to imagine how the court can remedy this wrong without undermining the finality of bankruptcy orders generally. It is equally difficult to imagine how the court can rule in favor of the respondent without providing an incentive to future debtors to include a non-dischargeable debt in their bankruptcy plans. One possible solution suggested by Justice Alito at oral argument is to sanction any lawyer who attempts to include non-dischargeable debts in bankruptcy plans. The problem with this proposal is that many, if not most, Chapter 13 petitioners file for bankruptcy without the aid of counsel or of a lawyer. Threatening sanctions would be meaningless were no lawyer assisted in the preparation of the bankruptcy plan. While I'm sure that the court is reluctant to approve of the discharge of a non-dischargeable debt in this manner, it must be at least equally loath to undermine the finality of bankruptcy court orders.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.